Hi, I'm Sean L. McCarthy, founding editor of The Comics Comic, found wherever you can type The Comics Comic into your electronic devices. Welcome to Last Things First, the show that asks comedians about the historic lasts and firsts in their lives as their comedy careers have blossomed, from young people with dreams to adult people living those dreams, or still dreaming. Questions both big and small are asked and answered. It's hopefully both amusing and illuminating.
Kara Connors grew up in Chicago, but she began her comedy career in Toronto, where she studied with The Second City, created and starred in an original series for CBC, provided social media humor for the series Working Moms, and earned herself a new faces slot with Just for Laughs. Since moving back to the States and settling down in Los Angeles, Connors has been seen on E! In the series Dating #NoFilter, and launched her own queer-friendly live comedy show, Straight for Pay. That's also the name for her one-person show that received rave reviews from me and others at the 2023 Edinburgh Fringe, and it's become both her stand-up comedy album and special debut. The album came out in 2023 and the special in March 2024 via Comedy Dynamics. Connors sat down with me over Zoom where we talked about the process for getting onto the cast of The Groundlings, how an American comedian starts her career in Canada, finding her true voice on stage and off, her perspective on comedians like Meg Stalter while working the Edinburgh Fringe alongside her, starting over in LA, how she almost performed on NBC's Bring the Funny primetime comedy competition series, and the importance of hosting and producing her own live show. There's a lot to get to, so let's get to it!
Congratulations on Straight for Pay, the new special out now everywhere. You know that I love you already because my review of your Edinburgh show is in your press clippings.
That's right.
So last things first, because of that, I need to know this just so I can feel okay.
Okay.
One of the quotes that's used by me describes you as part Sandra Bernhard, part Kristen Wiig. Mm-hmm. How off base am I?
Oh, I mean, I hope you're not off base at all. I love both of those comedians. I think that I got to see Sandra Bernhard live because I went to the Netflix, like they had that queer special, like Wanda Sykes company.
Oh yeah. Together. Yeah. At the Greek, I think it was.
Yeah. So I got to see her live, which was amazing. They brought out like her own separate, she had like a rug that was on stage. Like she was the only comedian that basically a mini set was built like in between. So I feel like I appreciate the like no nonsense sort of New Yorker theatrical side. And then, I mean, Kristen Wiig is one of my all-time faves and Groundlings alum. And so, yeah, hopefully you're not off base. I appreciate the comparison. I love both of them so much.
Thanks. I feel partially vindicated because since I saw you in Edinburgh last summer, you have been accepted into the Sunday company at the Groundlings.
Yeah. So I think it was, you must have like maybe seen something before I did, because I was just kind of on the wait list for that next level for about 2 years and then finally got to, you know, because their whole program is very like a steep mountain peak and then you have to do everything and there's a lot of, it's very emotional and intense. So I got back and then they finally accepted me into that last part. And then, yeah, I just got into Sunday Company. And so now like, yeah, all of the, it's kind of like, I came out of the Toronto comedy scene, so I know all the famous Canadians, like you just have to learn them. So now kind of being in the Groundlings, you're learning more and more all the different people that came through that. And so, you know, the Kristen Wiig lore is definitely strong.
Okay. So two things you mentioned there that I want to follow up on just real quick. What exactly is the process to get into either the main company or the Sunday company at the Groundlings? I was just under the presumption that it's basically auditioning like for anything else, but there's a process or there's levels.
Oh, yeah. So I started, it's different for everybody, but most people it's like, I think on average, it takes people like anywhere from 5 to 10 years to maybe get into Sunday company. So I started with them, like I took my first class with them maybe in 2018 when I first moved to LA. But basically there's kind of like three, or they might have just changed like the names of the classes, but there's like three core track levels. and you have to work your way through them. And then basically you can take each class. You have to pass each class. Obviously, you can retake the first two, I think, up to three times. So it's all about like they fail people constantly. You have to retake it. It's all about kind of like making everybody sort of go. It's just like an acting conservatory and kind of making everybody go through this very rigorous process. So once you make it through the first three, it's like basic improv, then intermediate, you're learning about characters, then advanced, you're learning how to kind of combine those things. And then if you make it through that, then you're into the like this next track, and you have to do the writing lab, which is usually like a year on a waiting list. You take the writing lab, you have like a former Groundling main stager or a current main stager who directs it. It's like 2 months long. You write one full show with everybody in the cast. Then at the end, you're voted on by like a handful of groundlings. Then you're on another wait list for a couple of years. Then you take advanced writing lab. You do a 4-month-long process. You write two main stage shows, and then the groundlings vote on you. And
Ooh.
then if you pass through that, then you are invited into Sunday Company. But like at every level, the numbers just get smaller and smaller, and then the stakes get higher. And there's, yeah, I'm still learning. I think the more that I've gotten into Groundlings, the less that I feel like I know. I'm like on Reddit, like looking up like what's coming next. Like it's so like, yeah, there's just definitely like a there's just almost like an Illuminati, vibe, or I'm kind of waiting to be sort of brought into a room with cloaks. And yeah, so it's very exciting, but also equally terrifying.
That's
So.
kind of crazy to hear, just for the sake of I started writing about comedy on the internet 20 years ago at this point, and to hear you talk about trying to understand what the Groundlings are like now going on Reddit. 20 years ago, people had no idea. People who wanted to get into comedy had no idea. Like, you just like looked in the yellow pages or the newspaper and
Yeah. I mean, it's all word of mouth, but that's how it is throughout the process. You kind of get to the next level, and then, oh, well, I have a friend of a friend who auditioned for this 4 years ago, and they said that you need to do that. So it's all kind of this mysterious process, and people kind of take different approaches and strategies of how they're going to advance through it. And I definitely have and had somewhat of an ignorance is bliss type of thing, where I've just focused on the performance side of it and kind of the kinds of characters that I wanted to write, and just kind of fingers crossed that, that they would vote for me or something, because I knew maybe three of the main stage cast, like they taught me or something over the years, but the rest of them I had just seen perform. And
So the other thing you mentioned, and I guess this maybe ties into your ignorance is bliss statement, is you mentioned coming up through Toronto, and you're not Canadian.
Well, I'm not. No, I was born in
You're
Chicago.
born in Chicago. As you joke in
Right.
your special, you went to Iona, which is just
Yes.
outside of New York City. Usually we talk about the great Canadian comedians who come to America to make it. We never talk about American comedians who go to Canada to make it. So what was that calculus for you?
Well, I grew up in Chicago, famous comedy city, never did any comedy, was just a fan and would go and see a bunch of shows. Like my cousin, used to be on Second City main stage, and now she's like directing for them. So I would take the little bus into the city and go and watch her improv shows like in the basement at IO, but just purely as a fan. And then I was in New York for undergrad. I'd walk by UCB every day on the way to work. I used to be like a case manager right after I got out of college. And I was like, oh yeah, that would be fun, but never really considered it. And then I moved to Toronto when I famously got straight married and didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I went to grad school like every other millennial that doesn't know what the hell they want to do. So I went to grad school and then I hated it. And I was not doing anything with comedy at all. And then the summer after my first year of grad school, I was like, I don't want to go back. Don't make me. This is terrible. So I was like, I need to do something to kind of make myself feel better in Second City in Toronto. I recognized it because I knew it from Chicago. So I was like, I'm going to go take a class. Just to have something fun to do over the summer. So that's when I started. So I didn't seek it out, but I didn't start until I got to Canada. And then once I got into the Second City system, and then I started doing stand up, and then it was just like I was immediately hooked. And then by the time the fall came around, I didn't want to go back to school for even more reasons, but I still did. So I can teach K through 8 in Ontario.
Okay, so which came first, your comedy awakening or your sexual awakening?
Comedy awakening, which then, of course, is a very slippery slope, as
It's
I'm
a
sure
gateway
many
drug
comedians, it
to
really
queer.
is. Yeah, because then I was around like all of these. I mean, yeah, I'm really grateful kind of for how it all worked out, because I'm so glad that I started in Toronto and was in Canada, because I met so many amazing people and I was collaborating. And again, I didn't really know or understand what I was getting myself into. I was just trying to make big, weird, foolish choices on stage and then find other people who were kind of in that same mentality. And so I made so many good friends and I got so much stage time. And I did end up kind of getting opportunities that did help me to move to LA, like because that's how I got in through JFL. I got new faces through the Canadian side, and then I did like the Winnipeg Comedy Festival like a week after I moved out of my ex's house. Like all of the timing was very overlapping. So yeah, it was about a year into comedy that I realized that I was not a straight comedian.
So that first
Yeah.
year, when you thought you were a straight comedian, was your comedy different?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, but also it was, my first year doing comedy, and so I was just trying to get as much stage time as possible. But I keep all of my notebooks and everything, and I mean, I was writing jokes. My subconscious was writing jokes that I didn't even connect was happening. So I would write jokes about like, I have a husband. I know, you're probably surprised, but in my real life, day to day, I was not making any of those connections, but I had enough awareness to be able to write jokes about how I was maybe coming across. But yeah, so I mean, but style wise, I think I don't even, yeah, I mean, clothing wise, I definitely was dressing a lot uglier, but that's when I was
Uglier.
cosplaying. Yeah. I mean, for myself, but like
Okay.
people like, seem to like it maybe, but I didn't like it. Yeah. Like I was wearing like red lip gloss. I'm like, I don't know what's going on. So
Okay, so uglier for you is red lip gloss. Beautiful for you is fringe shirts.
that's right. Yes. Dressing like some kind of weird gay cowboy, for me is the epitome of beauty for myself, not, I don't want to force anybody into it, but yeah.
Right. But
Yeah.
if I think of your stand up as like Sandra Bernhard now, then, if you were in the red lip gloss, what were you more like? Were you more like.
Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, I think that my earliest, like when I was like first starting to write jokes, I think that, Sarah Silverman was definitely an influence.
Okay.
I think I was trying to kind of do some shock value sort of with certain jokes, or like, you're not going to expect me to say this. And I also really specifically remember for at least like the first 3 years doing stand up that I was really trying to keep myself like physically still and to calm myself down, because I didn't want to come across like I was like too hyper or weird or. So I think I was a lot more restrained. And then there was a certain point where something shifted, and then I kind of decided like, well, what if I do the opposite and I actually just lean into the way that I naturally am instead of trying to hide it? And then that kind of unlocked something, because then yeah, it kind of just gave me permission to do whatever I wanted, and then audiences would respond to that, because audiences, like when you just names what is actually happening in front of them, it's almost like a it builds trust with them, and it's like an easy laugh. So instead of trying to hide that I'm fidgeting or hide that I sometimes like don't know where to look or my mind is overlapping and going in all these different directions, like just I would just kind of opened the gates and went with that. And then the people that liked it could ride along with me, and the people that didn't like it were never going to like it anyway. So I didn't need to like pretend that I was, you know, something else. But that was like a scary, I think, kind of choice. But then once I started doing it, then there was no going back. Like I couldn't now walk on and kind of, I don't even know, you know, be a very sort of like, I don't know.
You do like have an impersonation reel. Could you impersonate Wendy Liebman, for example? Not right now. I'm not asking you for an on demand, but like if you.
I think I can impersonate, I could probably impersonate most people, I think. I mean, I and most comedians, that's some of my favorite thing to impersonate. But yeah, it would be a choice. It would be like doing it as a character, and I've thought of that as well, because I'm very inspired by, you know, Kate Berlant and Kat Cohen, and I love comedians that kind of commit to this very specific, like outlandish character that's very specific to them. So I've thought about that. Would it be kind of fun to do, you know, almost do a character? And in some ways it is, but it's closer to who I am. But yeah, I guess I don't know if I would want to, yeah, impersonate somebody else at this point. With stand up, I'm trying to still kind of find my voice. I have it in my head of people saying, you know, it takes stand-ups like 7 years or something. I'm like, okay, I'm going on 10, and I'm like, all right, I think I'm just starting to scratch the surface. So
Right.
that feels like
Well,
exciting though.
right. I mean, that's something that pretty much all stand-up comedians have to go through this phase where, for their first year, they're channeling somebody else, or it's their influence, or it's their idol, it's what they think a stand-up should be. And then it's only once they get comfortable on stage that they're like, oh, no, wait, this is who I am. And, you know, you have that extra layer of like realizing, oh, you're also coming to terms with, oh, wait, I'm a completely different person, not just as a comedian, but as a person. I'm
As
living
a
this
person,
lie. I need to live in my truth. But at the same time, you know, we were just talking about characters, and it reminded me that when I saw you in Edinburgh, I realized like you had this connection with Meg Stalter through your partner Maddie, who was performing with Meg. And Meg's whole thing is not being, I have no idea who Meg is as like a real person off stage, because Meg on stage is just this caricature.
I mean, and Meg, I mean, Meg is so funny and really interesting too. And I think that one of the reasons that her character and persona on stage works and is so funny, especially if you get to know her personally, is it is that's not how she is at all. She is like the sweetest, kindest person. And so to me, that's why that caricature is so funny, because when you're watching her and she's kind of yelling at people and just like, oh, come on, sweet, with the lights. I don't, you know, and like it's so funny because it's so far away from what she is. But then I know that she has said that people that are watching her, yeah, they don't necessarily know. And that's kind of part of the fun. But you know, I think maybe people intuitively know that underneath that, that's not where she's coming from, and that's why it's funny, and she's making fun of that aspect. Like, it's not as fun to watch somebody kind of go around and act like they're being some diva or some tyrant if you're like, eh, is this a character? I kind of feel like that's probably what you are actually like. So I think for her, that's why it works. You know, people just do know, and then they like her fans feel like they're inside the joke because they get it. And I think that was part of the fun too with the Edinburgh audiences, that it was this mix of like her hardcore fans who were dying to see her, and then people who didn't know her at all but were coming in just because it was like a hot ticket and they wanted to see, and they didn't know what to expect. And some of them loved it right away, and then some of them were like, I don't know what the hell is going on. But then the audience that knows what's going on loves laughing at them. So it's like this whole, she creates these like swirls that are happening with everybody.
So, what was your Edinburgh experience like to contrast with Meg's?
My Edinburgh experience, I think, from what I've heard anecdotally from a lot of comedians, I think mine sounds like it was really positive, because it's like all over the map for everybody. I think I felt like I had been training for it in some ways and didn't really realize that I was going to be fit to deal with some of the challenges that I think were hard for everybody, myself included. But like, for example, flyering and these things, like, because I've done my own, like, I've produced my own shows and put together my own tours, I'm very used to having to emotionally kind of detach myself and just like go and pitch myself to a bunch of people over and over and just trust that the numbers will work out and the momentum will build. And I saw a lot of people around me that that was one of the hardest parts and kind of really shook them because, yeah, you're competing against 3,000 other shows and you're like, I'm not a famous comedian. I don't have this enormous following. And so I knew that my only chance was going to be, yeah, getting in there and like winning over people, like 5, 10, 15 people at a time, and then they would tell their friends. So I think that I was able to just kind of lock into this like mindset where I was able to just not take all that personally and just kind of go out and, yeah, flyering and just doing that every single day. So that was kind of my routine. Like I would every day wake up and I would see a show and then I would flyer for like 4 hours and then I would get ready for my show and then maybe do another spot. And then, you know, but I had a great experience. Like I loved being at the Pleasance. I loved being in my little bunker. I loved being in Edinburgh. It was a very like magical experience to me. I'd never had so many people at once who were all in one place who loved art and performance. And so it was like they were all there. You just had to find, you know, 50 people a night to come to your creepy bunker. Like, but I found it a lot easier than, you know, kind of being on tour and I'm in Atlanta and I'm like trying to go to random, you know, gay bars or random brunch places and I'm like cold pitching and they're like, why are you talking to me? Versus like, this is everybody's there. They're all sitting around, they're drunk at 11 a.m. and you just have to like, you know, find a lady who thinks that you kind of look like her granddaughter and then find like some, you know, like, so I also had help though, you know, I like had a street team that was helping flyer as well. And like, I made friends with them. I don't know, I can kind of sometimes be a little bit socially intimidated hanging out with comedians. So I'll often find myself like befriending security, the bartenders, the street teams. So like that was who I would usually like get a beer with at the end of the night a lot of the time. But then they, you know, really had my back and like really were like working hard for me. So I think like all those things together and they saw how much I cared. So then I think hopefully that made them want to like help or work harder because I wasn't just sitting around being like, go and go flyer for me. Like I'm too good for that or something like that. Like I was next to them. I'm like, yeah, this is brutal. Like just standing outside of like Patty Harrison's show after, like, if you liked that, like you might like this. It's down the hill and it's a lot smaller. And like, you know, just so yeah.
Yeah, for people who haven't done the Edinburgh Fringe or even been as a fan, as a consumer of comedy, it's quite overwhelming, even if you're not trying to mount your own show for 28 nights in a row.
It's extremely overwhelming. And yeah, I think like it's tough because there's a big overlap that a lot of performers are having the same experiences, but then there's people that are having drastically different experiences as well. And so it's, I think though, like finding a few of your people, you know, that kind of get it and can help you out just like emotionally to get through it. But yeah, I definitely had my like kind of jock athlete mindset on. And I was like, here we go. This is a marathon, not a sprint. Like,
You have to have that endurance to play water polo, so
that's right. That's exactly
it's a
right. And
lot.
yeah, and when people didn't
The
come to my
core and your
show,
legs, it's a lot. There's a lot going on.
yeah. And then it's like if they didn't want to take a flyer, like I could just beat the shit out of them and just kind of wrestle them into the. And that is sometimes, you know, how I filled the room. And I'm not afraid to.
5 years before that or so is when you moved from Toronto to LA. Did you feel overwhelmed when you moved to LA, or did you feel like you were primed and ready for whatever LA was going to have for you?
I think I felt both. I was really excited. And I mean, I still am excited. It was a dream that I had for a long time, even before doing comedy. I always like wanted to come to LA, wanted to come to California. And then I think that when everything kind of laid down the way that it did, and then I was like starting to build like early successes and in Toronto, and then, you know, got divorced and my world was kind of flipped upside down. And I'm like, yeah, I wasn't sure what was going to happen, but I made myself a promise that I was going to move to LA in 1 year. So I was just like, I mean, the year before I moved, Toronto is a good place to try to save up money because you have healthcare and the cost of living is really low, especially if you're willing to live how I have been willing to live over the years. So I lived in like a, you know, a house that was basically falling over with two young guys and my dog. And I was paying like 600 Canadian a month, and I still looked pretty straight. So I was booking a lot of commercials. So I was just trying to like bank my money as like much as I could, because I knew that once I got out there that I was going to take a big hit and that everybody basically had to start over. So it was overwhelming, but I'd also seen a lot of people do it. And I think that I did have an advantage because I was American. And so I know a lot of Canadian comedians who they have to work for 10 years in Canada to get their O1 to even have the opportunity to go. Then they still have to kind of start over or like have a setback. Then they build it back. And then eventually they take off anyway, if they're great. Like, you know, like Steph Tolev and people like that. Like, you know, she was maybe two or three like grades ahead of me, right? Like in Toronto. And so I remember like her being out here, and then now, you know, she's taken off and it's amazing. And like Deb DiGiovanni had been out here for a while. And so, and I love her so much. And so I think I had some touchstones of people, but then I also knew and still know like plenty of people who were like unbelievably talented and are unbelievably talented, but it's just like a matter of survival out here. And it's, there is just that piece of like, who can just kind of make it. It's not about making it of who's the funny. I feel like at a certain point, everybody is really funny and really talented and everybody's working their ass off. It's just like, who can hang for the longest? Like who can just like have these shitty jobs and keep their rent covered for 10 years until they finally do, you know, whatever gatekeeper says, all right, we'll throw you a bone and you can have this opportunity. So yeah, I don't know if I felt completely overwhelmed, because I think I did have some idea how brutal it was going to be. Like I knew it wasn't going to be like I was going to come out here and then the next day I was going to be, you know, hosting the Oscars or something like that.
Or the next day be giving commentary on Blind Dates on E.
Yeah. Well, that was very, yeah, I mean, that was very lucky. And it is kind of one of those things where I like did get extreme, like I did get extremely lucky that it laid down like that, because yeah, Dating No Filter was my first audition. And so that sounds psychotic, because it is. But yeah, I mean, I was like, I had like moved to LA for a month, like got my apartment, was getting it set up, and then was flying back to Toronto to like get all of my stuff and drive it over. And that's when they were like, we're still looking for like one person for the show. And so I like flew back and did like the screen test or the chemistry or whatever it was, flew back to Toronto like 24 hours later, and then was like driving across to LA. And then I found out that I got it as I was like crossing into Arizona. So it was very much this like movie magic moment. And it was like, wow, I can't believe this. Like, what are the chances? Like, holy shit, like what a good sign. And so it was amazing. And I'm so grateful. I can't believe that happened. And then the other side is like, but don't worry, I definitely got like my teeth kicked in for the next, like just repeatedly, you know, for the next several years. So it's like you have those highs, but then I can't tell you the number of things that it's been like, oh my God, I got something. And then I'm like, there was one thing where I was like, I was waiting the next morning. Well, I think I can say it. It was the like Bring the Funny, that like competition. The
yeah, last 2019's day, you know? NBC primetime competition.
That's right.
Home of
course.
Matt Rife made it on that show.
Right. Yep.
Michael Longfellow, who's now on SNL. Was that?
Yep.
Ali Sadiq.
Yep. Oh,
who's
yeah.
A couple of hit YouTube specials.
Yeah. So I was cast to be on that show and had been working with producers for months. And then the next day, it was like, Monday, I was supposed to be like our first day of filming, and I was waiting for an email to be like, here's your call sheet. And then I got an email instead that was like, unfortunately, like we've had to cut you. And it was just like, bye. Like that was it. And so it was like,
Oh my
oh
God.
my God. Yeah. So it's kind of like that kind of is a great example. Like that type of experience I've had now, like 50 times. Right. And so now, like, I don't even let myself get excited until if I'm physically on set and the camera is rolling, then I let myself get excited because it's just like, at any time, anybody can just kind of be like, sorry, bro. So, yeah, that was
But in the
crazy.
moment, though, that's got to be devastating.
Oh, it
You
was
think you're going
so,
to be on not just like, not to disparage the E television network, but this is NBC. This is network, prime time. They say you're going to be on, and it's the first day you're supposed to show up, and they tell you?
It
How did
was.
you get over, what did you do to get over that?
Honestly, I think that one of my main coping mechanisms is always like trying to have a lot of my own things that I'm working on always simultaneously. So then it's like, okay, all right, like I'm just gonna double down into the next thing. And so I think I honestly coped by just trying to keep it moving and like I let myself be really upset, but then I'm not a religious person at all, but for some reason, this like Southern mom quote of like, rejection is God's protection. I always do kind of abide by that. And it's like, if it's not, if it's meant for me, like it'll come. And so I definitely remember being devastated, but then it's also like, that's Hollywood, baby. Like I wasn't like, there's just part of me where it's like, yeah. And then I'll tell, and then I'm like, well, this will be a great story to tell one day when I make it on late night and then I'm sitting across, and then I can be like, Jimmy, baby, I gotta tell you a crazy story here. Like it's like that kind of so I comfort myself through like many comedians with like weird daydreams and things about how that will one day be funny. But it
How
was work.
important then was it for you to have Straight for Pay is also the name of your, it's now a monthly show, but back then it was a weekly show in Glendale. How important was it for you to have that show then to at least have some place to fall back on, to vent, to do whatever in that little bookstore-like
Yeah,
place?
that's right. Yeah, I mean, that has been a huge thing for sure because stage time in LA is a lot more hard to come by. Just comparing it just to Toronto, where I could have like several shows a night for years, and then coming out here, it's like maybe I'll have like a show or two a week, or depending on like what I'm kind of focusing on and pursuing that. So having like a regular space where it was my room and like I could kind of, vent and work out new stuff has been really key the whole time. I mean, I had like a weekly show in Toronto as well. That was like advice that a comedian gave to me early on. They were like, start your own show or start your own mic and at the very least, like it's gonna make you better at hosting. And if you're good at hosting, then you can do anything because if you can walk up to an audience that is cold and doesn't really consider you a comedian or part of the show, then you can do anything. And if you can get them going and improvise off of them. So I think like, yeah, having my own space has been super key. But at the time when the Bring the Funny thing happened, I didn't have that show yet. So I was just like kind of doing random, spots all over the place. And then now I would say like, my favorite places to perform in LA is like Dynasty Typewriter is definitely my number one. But I was still trying to figure out, I think the first couple of years here, like, oh, should I try to become like an, improv or the store or whatever? Like people choose kind of different tracks, especially out here because it is more limited. And I just never felt like I've performed at the Improv a decent amount of times, but I've just never felt like that was my like true home base. And so I think I've definitely always felt like on the indie circuit has always like felt more comfortable. And then I was like, yeah, there's just not enough There's only so many times that some of these shows can book you in a year or something. So I was like, okay, I think I have to start kind of my own thing now. And yeah, and so that's been a lot of fun.
Now that you've gotten straight for pay, the show through the Fringe, through all that circuit, you recorded it as an album, and then you did a separate version that you just taped that's out as we speak. Have you allowed yourself to think about like what comes next?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always kind of thinking about what is coming next, because I definitely don't want to ever allow myself a moment of peace. I don't think that that's good, with the creative spirit.
Serenity never.
No, exactly. I think that there's two things I'm like mainly focusing on now, which is like definitely going to be Sunday Company. And once I go in there, because that's like you get 6 months and you're doing a show every single week, and then you're being evaluated, and then the Groundlings vote on you again, and then they'll either kick you out or you're allowed to stay another 6 months, up to 18 months, or you're voted up into the main stage. So that will definitely be a main thing that I'll be focused on, and just like focusing on my character side of things, like at this point, like kind of starting to come out as like a character comedian or improv. It's something I've kept very close to my chest, although I've been pursuing it like parallel this whole time. But now I'm finally ready to like admit to my, cool stand-up friends that I am doing this.
Once again, you're coming out.
Literally, yeah, I know. And then and I've already been getting, roasted within an inch of my life from my stand-up friends. They're like, "Oh, you're gonna get into clowning. Uh-oh, it's coming. You're circling it. It's coming." And I'm like, "Don't tempt me." Yeah, I know. I'm like, I won't even let myself go there because I know that I would. I know that I would love it. It's like I already like love Natalie Palamides and like Zack Zucker and stuff. So I'm like, oh boy, yeah, it's a slippery slope. But I think that with the stand-up side, I'm still very inspired by Edinburgh and people like I want to go like even more personal and go deeper and kind of go to the earlier times. So I've been in the last year like starting to build a new hour that's like more autobiographical, like of just kind of where I came from. And like so right now I'm exploring that. Like I made a list of all the things that make me feel the most uncomfortable and ashamed. And then I try to write jokes towards that because it's like on the other side of those things is always really funny stuff. So that's what I'm piecing together. And then, maybe I'll make my Fringe return in the next few years or something with some kind of, that they love that. I mean, there's like trauma porn and everything is huge at Fringe. So, but maybe it'll be an immersive clown experience. I'll be cracking eggs on my head at the same time that I'm sort of exploring these childhood wounds.
Well, Kara Connors, I look forward to seeing all of that. I hope you weren't uncomfortable
No,
and afraid doing this because I really appreciate it. I love your work and I
not at
can't
all.
wait to
Thank
see
you.
your Groundlings phase and then your clown phase.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
This episode of The Comics Comic Presents Last Things First was post-produced by Alex Brazell at Showbiz Studios. The music was by Camille Harris and Shockwave, logo by Gigglechick. If you enjoyed listening, please check out my Substack called Piffany at piffany.substack.com for transcripts, bonus commentary, and expert analysis about comedy, show business, and more. I'm your host, Sean O. McCarthy. Thanks for listening.